Chapter 16. End of Socialism. The health of revolutionary Russia, however, is subject to one indispensable condition, that never, as one day happened even to the Church, should a black market of power be opened. Should the European correlation of power and money penetrate Russia too, then perhaps not the country, perhaps not even the party, but communism in Russia would be lost. Walter Benjamin. It is not true any more that a single official creed is the only operative guide to action. More than one ideology, a mixture of modes of thinking and frames of references, coexist, and not only in society at large, but also inside the party and inside the leadership. A rigid and codified Marxism-Leninism could not, except in official rhetoric, respond to the regime's real needs. M. Lewin in Kerblay. The key to achieving modernization is the development of science and technology. Empty talk will get our modernization program nowhere. We must have knowledge and trained personnel. Now it appears that China is fully 20 years behind the developed countries in science, technology, and education. As early as the Meiji Restoration, the Japanese began to expend a great deal of effort on science, technology, and education. The Meiji Restoration was a kind of modernization drive undertaken by the emerging Japanese bourgeoisie. As proletarians, we should and can do better. Deng Xiaoping, Respect Knowledge, Respect Trained Personnel, 1977. 1. One socialist country in the 1970s was particularly worried by its relative economic backwardness, if only because its neighbor, Japan, was the most spectacularly successful of the capitalist states. Chinese communism cannot be regarded simply as a subvariety of Soviet communism, still less as part of the Soviet satellite system. For one thing, it triumphed in a country with a far larger population than the USSR, or for that matter any other state. Even allowing for the uncertainties of Chinese demography, something like one out of every five human beings was a Chinese living on mainland China. There was also a substantial Chinese diaspora in East and Southeast Asia. Moreover, China was not only nationally far more homogeneous than most other countries, about 94% of its population were Han Chinese, but had formed a single, though intermittently disrupted, political unit, probably for a minimum of 2,000 years. Even more to the point, for most of these two millennia, the Chinese Empire, and probably most of its inhabitants who had a view on these matters, had considered China to be the center and model of world civilization. With minor exceptions, all other countries in which communist regimes triumphed, from the USSR on, were and saw themselves as culturally backward and marginal, relative to some more advanced and paradigmatic center of civilization. The very stridency with which the USSR insisted, in the Stalin years, on its lack of intellectual and technological dependence on the West, and on the indigenous source of all the leading inventions, from telephones to aircraft, was a telling symptom of this sense of inferiority. Not so China, which quite correctly saw its classical civilization, art, script, and social value system as the acknowledged inspiration and model for others, not least for Japan itself. It certainly had no sense whatever of any intellectual and cultural inferiority, either collectively or of individual Chinese, compared to any other people. The very fact that China had no neighbouring states which could even faintly threaten her, and thanks to adopting firearms, no longer had any difficulty in fending off the barbarians on its frontier, confirmed its sense of superiority, even as it made the empire unprepared for Western imperial expansion. The technological inferiority of China, which became only too evident in the 19th century because it was translated into military inferiority, was not due to technical or educational incapacity, but the very sense of self-sufficiency and self-confidence of traditional Chinese civilization. This made it reluctant to do what the Japanese did after the Meiji Restoration of 1868, plunge into modernization by adopting European models wholesale. This could and would be done only on the ruins of the ancient Chinese Empire, guardian of the old civilization, and through social revolution, which was at the same time a cultural revolution against the Confucian system. Chinese communism, therefore, was both social and, if the word does not beg questions, national. The social explosive which fueled communist revolution was the extraordinary poverty and oppression of the Chinese people, initially of the labouring masses in the great coastal cities of Central and South China, which formed enclaves of foreign imperialist control and sometimes modern industry, Shanghai, Canton, Hong Kong, later of the peasantry, which formed 90% of the country's vast population. Its condition was far worse than even the Chinese urban population, whose consumption per capita was something like 2.5 times higher. The sheer poverty of China is hard for Western readers to imagine. Thus, at the time of the communist takeover, 1952 data, the average Chinese lived essentially on 0.5 kilogram of rice or grains a day and consumed rather less than 0.08 kilos of tea a year. He or she acquired a new pair of footwear once every 5 years or so. The national element in Chinese communism operated both through the intellectuals of upper and middle class origin, who provided most of the leadership of all 20th century Chinese political movements, and through the feeling, undoubtedly widespread among the Chinese masses, that the barbarian foreigners meant no good to such Chinese individuals as they had dealings with, and to China as a whole. Since China had been attacked, defeated, partitioned, and exploited by every foreign state within reach since the middle of the 19th century, this assumption was not implausible. Mass anti-imperialist movements with a traditional ideology were already familiar before the end of the Chinese Empire, for instance the so-called Boxer Rising of 1900. There is little doubt that resistance to the Japanese conquest of China is what turned the Chinese communists from a defeated force of social agitators, which they were in the middle 1930s, into the leaders and representatives of the entire Chinese people. That they also called for the social liberation of the Chinese poor made their appeal for national liberation and regeneration sound more convincing to the mainly rural masses. In this, they had the advantage over their rivals. The older Kuomintang Party, which had attempted to rebuild a single, powerful Chinese republic out of the scattered warlord-led fragments of the Chinese Empire after its fall in 1911. The short-term objectives of the two parties did not seem incompatible. The political base of both was in the more advanced cities of South China, where the republic established its capital, and their leadership consisted of very much the same sort of educated elite, allowing for a certain bias towards businessmen in one, peasants and workers in the other. Both, for instance, contained virtually the same percentage of men drawn from the traditional landlords and scholar gentry, the elites of Imperial China, although the communists tended to have more leaders with a higher education of the Western type. Both movements came out of the anti-imperial movement of the 1900s, reinforced by the May movement, the national upsurge among students and teachers in Peking after 1919. Sun Yat-sen, the Kuomintang leader, was a patriot, democrat and socialist who relied for advice and support on Soviet Russia, the only revolutionary and anti-imperialist power, and found the Bolshevik model of the single state party more suited than Western models for his task. In fact, the communists became a major force largely through this Soviet tie-up, which allowed them to be integrated into the official national movement and, after Sun's death in 1925, to share in the great northern advance by which the Republic extended its influence into the half of China it did not control. Sun's successor, Chiang Kai-shek, 1897 to 1975, never managed to establish complete control over the country, even though in 1927 he broke with the Russians and suppressed the communists, whose main body of mass support at that time was among the small urban working class. The communists, forced to turn their main attention to the countryside, now waged a peasant-based guerrilla war against the Kuomintang. On the whole, thanks not least to their own divisions and confusions and the remoteness of Moscow from Chinese realities, with little success. In 1934, their armies were forced to retreat to a remote corner of the far northwest in the heroic Long March. These developments made Mao Zedong, who had long favoured the rural strategy, into the disputed leader of the Communist Party in its exile in Yan'an, but did not offer any immediate prospects of communist advance. On the contrary, the Kuomintang steadily extended their control over most of the country until the Japanese invasion of 1937. Yet the Kuomintang's lack of a genuine mass appeal to the Chinese, as well as its abandonment of the revolutionary project, which was at the same time a project of modernization and regeneration, made them no match for their communist rivals. Chiang Kai-shek never became an Ataturk, another head of a modernizing, anti-imperialist national revolution who found himself making friends with the young Soviet Republic, using the local communists for his own purposes and turning away from them, though less stridently than Chiang. Like Ataturk, he had an army, but it was not an army with national loyalty, let alone the revolutionary morale of the communist armies, but a force recruited from among men for whom, in times of trouble and social collapse, a uniform and a gun are the best way to get by, and officered by men who knew, as did Mao Zedong himself, that at such times power grew from the barrel of a gun, and so did profit and wealth. He had a good deal of urban middle-class support, and perhaps even more support from the wealthy overseas Chinese, but 90% of Chinese and almost all the country's territory were outside the cities. They were controlled, if at all, by local notables and men of power, from warlords with their armed men to gentry families and relics of the imperial power structure with whom the Kuomintang came to terms. When the Japanese set out to conquer China seriously, the Kuomintang armies could not prevent them from almost immediately overrunning the coastal cities, where its genuine strength lay. In the rest of China, they became what they had always potentially been, another corrupt landlord-warlord regime resisting the Japanese ineffectively, if at all. Meanwhile, the communists effectively mobilized mass resistance to the Japanese in the occupied areas. When they took over China in 1949, having almost contemptuously swept aside the Kuomintang forces in a brief civil war, they were, for all except the fleeing remnants of the Kuomintang power, the legitimate government of China, true successors to the imperial dynasties after a 40 years interregnum. And they were all the more readily accepted as such because from their experience as a Marxist-Leninist party, they were able to forge a nationwide, disciplined organization capable of bringing government policy from the center to the remotest villages of the giant country, as, in the mind of most Chinese, a proper empire should do. Organization, rather than doctrine, was the chief contribution of Lenin's Bolshevism to changing the world. Yet, of course, they were more than the empire revived, even though they undoubtedly benefited from the enormous continuities of Chinese history, which established both how ordinary Chinese expected to relate to any government, enjoying the mandate of heaven, and how those who administered China expected to think about their tasks. There is no other country in which political debates within a communist system would have been conducted by reference to what a loyal Mandarin said to the Ming Emperor Jia Qing in the 16th century. That is what a hard-nosed old China watcher, the London Times correspondent, meant in the 1950s by the claim, shocking to those who heard it at the time, like the present writer, that there would be no communism left in the 21st century except in China, where it would survive as the national ideology. For most Chinese, this was a revolution which was primarily a restoration of order and peace, of welfare, of a system of government whose civil servants found themselves appealing to precedents from the Tang dynasty, of the greatness of a great empire and civilization. And for the first few years, that is what most Chinese seemed to be getting. Peasants raised their output of food grains by more than 70% between 1949 and 1956, presumably because they were not yet interfered with too much, and while China's intervention in the Korean War of 1950 to 1952 created a serious panic, the ability of the Chinese Communist Army first to defeat, then to hold at bay the mighty USA could hardly fail to impress. Planning for industrial and educational development began in the early 1950s. Yet very soon, the new People's Republic, under the now unchallenged and unchallengeable Mao, began to enter 2 decades of largely arbitrary catastrophes provoked by the great helmsman. From 1956, the rapidly deteriorating relations with the USSR, which ended in the clamorous breach between the two communist powers in 1960, led to the withdrawal of the important technical and other material aid from Moscow. However, this complicated rather than caused the Calvary of the Chinese people, which was marked by three main stations of the cross, the ultra-rapid collectivization of peasant farming in 1955 to 1957, the great leap forward of industry in 1958, followed by the Great Famine of 1959 to 1961, probably the greatest famine of the 20th century, and the 10 years of Cultural Revolution, which ended with Mao's death in 1976. These cataclysmic plunges were, it is generally agreed, due largely to Mao himself, whose policies were often received with reluctance in the party leadership, and sometimes, most notably in the case of the Great Leap Forward, with frank opposition, which he overcame only by launching the Cultural Revolution. Yet they cannot be understood without a sense of the peculiarities of Chinese communism, of which Mao made himself the spokesman. Unlike Russian communism, Chinese communism had virtually no direct relations with Marx and Marxism. It was a post-October movement which came to Marx via Lenin, or more precisely, Stalin's Marxist-Leninism. Mao's own knowledge of Marxist theory seems to have been almost entirely derived from the Stalinist History of the CPSU, B, short course, of 1939. And yet below the Marxist-Leninist top-dressing, there was, and this is very evident in the case of Mao, who never travelled outside China until he became head of state, and whose intellectual formation was entirely homegrown, a very Chinese utopianism. This naturally had points of contact with Marxism. All social revolutionary utopias have something in common, and Mao, no doubt in complete sincerity, seized on those aspects of Marx and Lenin which fitted into his vision and used them to justify it. Yet his view of an ideal society united by a total consensus, and in which, it has been said, the individual's total self-abnegation and total immersion in the collectivity are ultimate goods, a kind of collectivist mysticism, is the opposite of classical Marxism, which, at least in theory and as the ultimate object, envisaged the complete liberation and self-fulfillment of the individual. The characteristic emphasis on the power of spiritual transformation to bring this about by remoulding man, though it seizes on Lenin's and later Stalin's belief in consciousness and voluntarism, went far beyond it. With all his belief in the role of political action and decision, Lenin never lost sight of the fact, how could he have done, that practical circumstances imposed severe constraints on the effectiveness of action, and even Stalin recognized that his power had limits. Yet without the belief that subjective forces were all-powerful, that men could move mountains and storm heaven if they wanted to, the lunacies of the Great Leap Forward are inconceivable. Experts told you what could and could not be done, but revolutionary fervour alone could overcome all material obstacles and mind transform matter. Hence, to be read was not so much more important than to be expert, but its alternative. A unanimous surge of enthusiasm in 1958 would industrialize China immediately, leaping across the ages into the future when communism would immediately come into full operation. The countless little low-quality backyard furnaces by which China was to double its steel output within 1 year, and did actually more than treble it by 1960, before it fell back by 1962 to less than it had been before the Great Leap, represented one side of the transformation. The 24,000 people's communes of farmers set up in a mere 2 months of 1958 represented the other side. They were completely communist, not only in that all aspects of peasant life were collectivized, including family life, communal nurseries and mess halls, freeing women from household and childcare and sending them regimented into the fields, but the free supply of six basic services were to replace wages and money income. These six services were food, medical care, education, funerals, haircuts, and movies. Patently, this did not work. Within months, faced with passive resistance, the extremer aspects of the system were abandoned, though not before it had, like Stalin's collectivization, combined with nature to produce the famine of 1960 to 1961. In one way, this belief in the capacity of willed transformation rested on a more specific Maoist belief in the people, ready to be transformed and hence to take part creatively and with all the traditional Chinese intelligence and ingenuity in the great march forward. It was the essentially romantic view of an artist, though one gathers from those who can judge the poetry and calligraphy he likes to practice, not a very good one. Not as bad as Hitler's painting, but not as good as Churchill's, in the view of the British Orientalist Arthur Whaley, using painting as an analogy for poetry. It led him, against the sceptical and realistic advice of other communist leaders, to call on the intellectuals of the old elite to contribute their gifts freely in the Hundred Flowers campaign of 1956 to 1957, on the assumption that the revolution, and perhaps he himself, had already transformed them. Let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools of thought contend. When, as less inspirational comrades had foreseen, this outburst of free thought proved lacking in unanimous enthusiasm for the new order, Mao's native distrust of intellectuals as such was confirmed. It was to find spectacular expression in the 10 years of the Great Cultural Revolution, when higher education virtually came to a complete stop, and such intellectuals as already existed were massively regenerated by compulsory physical labour in the countryside. Nevertheless, Mao's belief in the peasants, who were urged to solve all the problems of production during the Great Leap on the principle of letting all schools, that is to say, of local experience, contend, remained unaffected. For, and this was yet another aspect of Mao's thought which found support in what he read into the Marxist dialectic, Mao was fundamentally convinced of the importance of struggle, conflict, and high tension as something that was not only essential to life, but prevented the relapse into the weaknesses of the old Chinese society, whose very insistence on unchanging permanence and harmony had been its weakness. The revolution, communism itself, could only be saved from degeneration into stasis by a constantly renewed struggle. Revolution could never end. The peculiarity of the Maoist policy was that it was at once an extreme form of westernization and a partial reversion to traditional patterns, on which indeed it largely relied, for the old Chinese empire was characterized, at least in the periods when the emperor's power was strong and secure, and therefore legitimate, by the autocracy of the ruler and the acquiescence and obedience of the subjects. The mere fact that 84% of Chinese peasant households had allowed themselves to be quietly collectivized within a single year, 1956, apparently without any of the consequences of Soviet collectivization, speaks for itself. Industrialization, on the heavy industry-inflected Soviet model, was the unconditional priority. The murderous absurdities of the Great Leap were due primarily to the conviction, which the Chinese regime shared with the Soviet, that agriculture must both supply industrialization and maintain itself without the diversion of resources from industrial to farming investment. Essentially, this meant substituting moral for material incentives, which meant in practice the almost unlimited amount of human muscle power available in China for the technology that was not available. At the same time, the countryside remained the foundation of Mao's system, as it had ever since the guerrilla epoch, and, unlike the USSR, the Great Leap model made it the preferred locus of industrialization also. Unlike the USSR, China experienced no mass urbanization under Mao. Not until the 1980s did the rural population fall below 80%. However much we may be shocked by the record of the 20 Maoist years, a record combining mass inhumanity and obscurantism with the surrealist absurdities of the claims made on behalf of the divine leader's thoughts, we should not allow ourselves to forget that, by the standards of the poverty-stricken Third World, the Chinese people were doing well. At the end of the Mao period, the average Chinese food consumption, in calories, ranked just above the median of all countries, above 14 countries in the Americas, 38 in Africa, and just about in the middle of the Asian ones, well above all South and Southeast Asia, except Malaysia and Singapore. The average expectation of life at birth rose from 35 years in 1949 to 68 in 1982, mainly owing to a dramatic and, except for the famine years, continuous fall in the mortality rate. Since the Chinese population, even allowing for the Great Famine, grew from around 540 to around 950 million between 1949 and Mao's death, it is evident that the economy managed to feed them, a little above the level of the early 1950s, and it slightly improved their supply of clothing. Education, even at the elementary level, suffered both from the famine, which cut attendance down by 25 millions, and from the Cultural Revolution, which reduced it by 15 millions. Nevertheless, there is no denying that in the year of Mao's death, six times as many children went to primary school as when he came to power. That is to say, a 96% enrollment rate compared to less than 50% even in 1952. Admittedly, even in 1987, more than a quarter of the population over the age of 12 remained illiterate and semi-literate. Among women, this figure was as high as 38%. But we should not forget that literacy in Chinese is unusually difficult, and only a fairly small proportion of the 34% born before 1949 could have been expected to have acquired it fully. In short, while the achievement of the Maoist period might not impress sceptical Western observers, there were many who lacked scepticism, it would certainly have appeared impressive to, say, Indian or Indonesian ones, and it might not have looked particularly disappointing to the 80% of rural Chinese, isolated from the world, whose expectations were those of their fathers. Nevertheless, it was undeniable that internationally China had lost ground since the revolution, and notably in relation to its non-communist neighbours. Its rate of economic growth per capita, though impressive in the Mao years, 1960 to 1975, was less than that of Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea and Taiwan, to name the East Asian countries which Chinese observers would certainly keep an eye on. Vast though it was, its total GNP was just about the same size as Canada's, less than Italy's and a mere quarter of Japan's. The disastrous zigzag course steered by the great helmsman since the middle 1950s had continued only because Mao, in 1965, with military backing, launched an anarchic, initially student movement of young Red Guards against the party leadership which had quietly sidelined him and intellectuals of any kind. This was the great Cultural Revolution which devastated China for some time, until Mao called in the army to restore order and in any case found himself obliged to restore some kind of party control. Since he was plainly on his last legs and Maoism without him had very little real support, it did not survive his death in 1976 and the almost immediate arrest of the Gang of Four ultra-Maoists, headed by the leader's widow, Jiang Qing. The new course, under the pragmatical Deng Xiaoping, began immediately. 2. Deng's new course in China was the frankest public recognition that dramatic changes in the structure of really existing socialism were needed, but as the 1970s turned into the 1980s, it was increasingly evident that something was seriously wrong with all socialist systems that claimed to have come into being. The slowing down of the Soviet economy was palpable. The rate of growth of almost everything that counted and could be counted in it fell steadily from 1 5-year period to the next after 1970. Gross domestic product, industrial output, farming output, capital investment, productivity of labour, real income per head. If not actually regressing, the economy was advancing at the pace of an increasingly tired ox. Moreover, so far from becoming one of the industrial giants of world trade, the USSR appeared to be internationally regressing. In 1960, its major exports had been machinery, equipment, means of transport, and metals or metal articles. But in 1985, it relied for its exports, primarily, 53%, on energy, that is to say, oil and gas. Conversely, almost 60% of its imports consisted of machinery, metals, and so on, and industrial consumer articles. It had become something like an energy-producing colony of more advanced industrial economies, that is to say, in practice largely its own Western satellites, notably Czechoslovakia and the German Democratic Republic, whose industries could rely on the unlimited and undemanding market of the USSR without doing much to improve their own deficiencies. In fact, by the 1970s, it was clear that not only economic growth was lagging, but even the basic social indicators, such as mortality, were ceasing to improve. This undermined confidence in socialism, perhaps more than anything else, since its ability to improve the lives of ordinary people through greater social justice did not depend primarily on its ability to generate greater wealth. That the average expectation of life at birth in the USSR, Poland and Hungary remained virtually unchanged during the last 20 years before the collapse of communism, indeed from time to time it actually dipped, was cause for serious worry, for in most other countries it continued to rise, including, it ought to be said, in Cuba and the Asian communist countries about which we have data. In 1969, Austrians, Finns and Poles could expect to die at the same average age, 70.1 years. But in 1989, Poles had a life expectancy about 4 years shorter than Austrians and Finns. This may have made people healthier, as demographers suggested, but only because in socialist countries people died who might have been kept alive in capitalist ones. Reformers in the USSR and elsewhere did not fail to observe these trends with growing anxiety. About this time, another symptom of recognized decline in the USSR is reflected in the rise of the term nomenklatura. It appears to reach the West via dissident writings. Until then, the officer corps of party cadres, which constituted the command system of the Leninist states, had been regarded abroad with respect and reluctant admiration, although defeated oppositionists at home, like the Trotskyites, and in Yugoslavia, Milovan Djilas, had pointed out its potential for bureaucratic degeneration and personal corruption. Indeed, in the 1950s, even into the 1960s, the general tone of Western and especially US comment had been that here, in the organizational system of the communist parties and its body of monolithic, selfless cadres, loyally, if brutally, carrying out the line, was the secret of communism's global advance. On the other hand, the term nomenklatura, practically unknown before 1980, except as part of CPSU administrative jargon, came to suggest precisely the weaknesses of the self-serving party bureaucracy of the Brezhnev era, a combination of incompetence and corruption. And indeed, it became increasingly evident that the USSR itself operated primarily through a system of patronage, nepotism, and payment. With the exception of Hungary, serious attempts to reform the socialist economies in Europe had been in effect abandoned in despair after the Prague Spring. As for the occasional attempts to revert to the old command economies in a Stalinist form, as in Ceausescu's Romania, or in the Maoist form, which substituted voluntarism and putative moral zeal for economics, as with Fidel Castro, the less said about them the better. The Brezhnev years were to be called the era of stagnation by the reformers, essentially because the regime had stopped trying to do anything serious about a visibly declining economy. Buying wheat on the world market was easier than trying to cure the apparently growing inability of Soviet agriculture to feed the people of the USSR. Lubricating the rusty engine of the economy by means of a universal and omnipresent system of bribery and corruption was easier than to clean and retune, let alone to replace it. Who knew what would happen in the long run? In the short run, it seemed more important to keep the consumers happy, or at any rate to keep their discontent within limits. Hence, probably in the first half of the 1970s, most inhabitants of the USSR were and felt better off than at any other time within living memory. The trouble for really existing socialism in Europe was that, unlike the interwar USSR, which was virtually outside the world economy and therefore immune to the great slump, now socialism was increasingly involved in it and therefore not immune to the shocks of the 1970s. It is an irony of history that the real socialist economies of Europe and the USSR, as well as parts of the Third World, became the real victims of the post-Golden Age crisis of the global capitalist economy, whereas the developed market economies, though shaken, made their way through the difficult years without major trouble, at least until the early 1990s. Until then, some, indeed like Germany and Japan, barely faltered in their forward march. Real socialism, however, now confronted not only its own increasingly insoluble systemic problems, but also those of a changing and problematic world economy into which it was increasingly integrated. This may be illustrated by the ambiguous example of the international oil crisis, which transformed the world energy market after 1973. Ambiguous because its effects were potentially both negative and positive. Under pressure from the global oil producers' cartel, OPEC, the organization of petrol-exporting countries, the oil price, low and in real terms actually falling since the war, more or less quadrupled in 1973 and more or less trebled again at the end of the 1970s in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution. Indeed, the actual range of fluctuations was even more dramatic. In 1970, oil was selling at an average price of $2.53 a barrel. But in late 1980, a barrel was worth about $41. The oil crisis had two apparently fortunate consequences. For oil producers, of whom the USSR happened to be one of the most important, it turned black liquid into gold. It was like a guaranteed weekly winning ticket to the lottery. The millions simply rolled in without effort, postponing the need for economic reform and incidentally enabling the USSR to pay for its rapidly growing imports from the capitalist West with exported energy. Between 1970 and 1980, Soviet exports to the developed market economies rose from just under 19% of total exports to 32%. It has been suggested that it was this enormous and unforeseen bonanza that tempted Brezhnev's regime into a more active international policy of competing with the USA in the middle 1970s, as revolutionary unrest once again swept the Third World, and into the suicidal course of trying to match American arms superiority. The other apparently fortunate consequence of the oil crises was the flood of dollars which now spurted from multi-billionaire OPEC states, often with tiny populations, and which was distributed by the international banking system in the form of loans to anyone who wanted to borrow. Few developing countries resisted the temptation to take the millions thus shoveled into their pockets and which were to provoke the world debt crisis of the early 1980s. For the socialist countries which succumbed to it, notably Poland and Hungary, loans seemed a providential way of simultaneously paying for investment in accelerating growth and raising their people's standard of living. This only made the crisis of the 1980s more acute, for the socialist economies, and notably the free-spending Polish one, were too inflexible to utilize the influx of resources productively. The mere fact that oil consumption in Western Europe, 1973 to 1985, fell by 40% in response to the rise in prices, but in the USSR and Eastern Europe by only little more than 20% in the same period, speaks for itself. That Soviet production costs increased sharply while the Romanian oil fields dried up makes the failure to economize energy even more striking. By the early 1980s, Eastern Europe was in an acute energy crisis. This in turn produced shortages of food and manufactured goods, except where, as in Hungary, the country plunged even more heavily into debt, accelerating inflation and lowering real wages. This was the situation in which really existing socialism in Europe entered what proved to be its final decade. The only immediate effective way of dealing with such a crisis was the traditional Stalinist recourse to strict central orders and restrictions, at least where central planning was still operational, as it no longer quite was in Hungary and Poland. It worked between 1981 and 1984. Debt fell by 35 to 70%, except in these two countries. This even encouraged illusory hopes of a return to dynamic economic growth without basic reforms, which brought about a great leap back to the debt crisis and further deterioration of economic perspectives. This was the moment when Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev became the leader of the USSR. 3. At this point, we must revert from the economics to the politics of really existing socialism, since politics, both high and low, were to bring about the Euro-Soviet collapse of 1989 to 1991. Politically, Eastern Europe was the Achilles heel of the Soviet system, and Poland, plus to a lesser extent Hungary, its most vulnerable spot. After the Prague Spring, it was clear, as we have seen, that the satellite communist regimes had lost all legitimacy as such in most of the region. They were maintained in being by state coercion, backed by the threat of Soviet intervention, or at best, as in Hungary, by giving the citizenry material conditions and relative freedom far superior to the East European average, but which the economic crisis made it impossible to maintain. However, with one exception, no serious form of organized political or other public opposition was possible. In Poland, the conjunction of three factors produced this possibility. The country's public opinion was overwhelmingly united, not only by a dislike of the regime, but by an anti-Russian and anti-Jewish and consciously Roman Catholic Polish nationalism. The church retained independent nationwide organization, and its working class had demonstrated its political power by massive strikes at intervals since the middle 1950s. The regime had long resigned itself to tacit toleration or even retreat, as when the strikes of 1970 forced the abdication of the then communist leader, so long as opposition was unorganized, though its room for maneuver shrank dangerously. But from the middle of the 1970s, it had to face both a politically organised labour movement, backed by a brains trust of politically sophisticated dissident intellectuals, mainly ex-Marxists, and also by an increasingly aggressive church, encouraged in 1978 by the election of the first Polish pope in history, Karol Wojtyła, John Paul II. In 1980, the triumph of the trade union movement Solidarity as, in effect, a national public opposition movement armed with the weapon of the mass strike demonstrated two things: that the Communist Party regime in Poland was at the end of its tether, but also that it could not be overthrown by mass agitation. In 1981, church and state quietly agreed to preempt the danger of armed Soviet intervention, which was seriously considered by a few years of martial law under the commander of the armed forces, which could plausibly claim both communist and national legitimacy. Order was re-established with little trouble by the police rather than by the army. But in effect, the government, as helpless as ever to cope with the economic problems, had nothing to set against an opposition which remained in being as the organised expression of the nation's public opinion. Either the Russians decided to intervene, or sooner rather than later, the regime had to abandon the key position of communist regimes, the one-party system under the leading role of the state party, that is to say, to abdicate. But as the rest of the satellite governments nervously watched the unfolding of this scenario, while mostly and vainly trying to stop their people from also doing so, it became increasingly evident that the Soviets were no longer prepared to intervene. In 1985, a passionate reformer, Mikhail Gorbachev, came to power as General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party. This was no accident. Indeed, but for the death of the desperately ill General Secretary and former chief of the security apparatus Yuri Andropov, 1914-1984, who had actually made the decisive break with the Brezhnev era in 1983, the era of change would have begun a year or two earlier. It was entirely evident to all other communist governments in and out of the Soviet orbit that major transformations were at hand, though quite unclear even to the new General Secretary what they would bring. The era of stagnation, zastoy, which Gorbachev denounced, had in fact been an era of acute political and cultural ferment among the Soviet elite. This included not only the relatively tiny group of self-co-opted Communist Party chieftains at the top of the union hierarchy, the only place where real political decisions were or could be made, but the relatively vast group of educated and technically trained middle classes, as well as the economic managers who actually kept the country going, academics, technical intelligentsia, experts and executives of various kinds. In some ways, Gorbachev himself represented this new educated cadre generation. He studied law, whereas the classical way up for the old Stalinist cadre had been, and still surprisingly often remained, from the factory floor via an engineering or agronomical degree into the apparatus. The depth of this ferment is not to be measured by the size of the actual group of public dissidents which now appeared, a few hundreds at most. Banned, or semi-legalized, through the influence of brave editors like that of the famous thick journal Novy Mir, criticism and self-criticism pervaded the cultural milieu of the metropolitan USSR under Brezhnev, including important sectors of party and state, notably in the security and foreign services. The enormous and sudden response to Gorbachev's call for glasnost, openness or transparency, can hardly be explained otherwise. Yet the response of the political and intellectual strata must not be taken as the response of the mass of Soviet peoples. For these, unlike the peoples of most European communist states, the Soviet regime was legitimate and entirely accepted, if only because they knew no other and could have known no other, except under German occupation in 1941-1944, which was hardly attractive. Every Hungarian over the age of 60 in 1990 had some adolescent or adult memory of the pre-communist era, but no inhabitant of the original USSR under the age of 88 could have had such first-hand experience. And if the government of the Soviet state had an unbroken continuity stretching back to the end of the Civil War, the country itself had an unbroken or virtually unbroken continuity stretching back even longer, except for the territories along the western border acquired or reacquired in 1939-1940. It was the old Tsarist Empire under new management. That, incidentally, is why before the late 1980s there was no sign of serious political separatism anywhere except in the Baltic countries, which had been independent states from 1918 to 1940, in the western Ukraine, which had been part of the Habsburg and not the Russian Empire before 1918, and perhaps in Bessarabia, Moldavia, which had been part of Romania from 1918 to 1940. Even in the Baltic states, there was little more open dissidence than in Russia. Moreover, the Soviet regime was not merely homegrown and domestically rooted. As time went on, even the party, originally much stronger among great Russians than other nationalities, recruited much the same percentage of inhabitants in the European and Transcaucasian republics. But the people itself, in ways difficult to specify, fitted themselves into it as the regime adjusted to them. As the dissident satirist Zinoviev pointed out, there really was a new Soviet man, even if he corresponded to his, or insofar as she was considered, which was hardly at all, her, official public image, no more than anything else did in the USSR. He, she, was at ease in the system. It provided a guaranteed livelihood and comprehensive social security at a modest but real level, a socially and economically egalitarian society, and at least one of the traditional aspirations of socialism, Paul Lafargue's right to idleness. Moreover, for most Soviet citizens, the Brezhnev era spelled not stagnation, but the best times they and their parents, or even grandparents, had ever known. Small wonder that radical reformers found themselves up against Soviet humanity as well as Soviet bureaucracy. In the characteristic tone of irritated anti-plebeian elitism, one reformer wrote, "Our society has generated a category of individuals supported by society and more interested in taking than in giving. This is the consequence of a policy of so-called egalitarianism, which has totally invaded Soviet society. That society is divided into two parts, those who decide and distribute and those who are commanded and who receive, constitutes one of the major breaks on the development of our society. Homo Sovieticus is both ballast and break. On the one hand, he is opposed to reform, on the other, he constitutes the base of support for the existing system." Socially and politically, most of the USSR was a stable society, no doubt partly by virtue of ignorance of other countries maintained by authority and censorship, but by no means only for this reason. Is it an accident that there had been no equivalent of the 1968 student rebellion in the USSR, unlike Poland, Czechoslovakia and Hungary? That even under Gorbachev, the reform movement did not mobilize the young to any great extent outside some Western nationalist regions? That it was, as the saying went, a rebellion of the 30 and 40-year-olds, that is to say, of the generation born after the end of the war but before the not uncomfortable torpor of the Brezhnev years. Wherever the pressure to change came from in the USSR, it was not from the grassroots. In fact, it came, as it had to come, from the top. Precisely how an obviously passionate and sincere communist reformer came to be Stalin's successor at the head of the Soviet CP on the 15th of March 1985 still remains unclear and will remain so until Soviet history in the last decades becomes a subject for history rather than accusation and self-exculpation. In any case, what matters are not the ins and outs of politics in the Kremlin, but the two conditions which allowed someone like Gorbachev to come to power. First, the growing and increasingly unconcealed corruption of the Communist Party leadership in the Brezhnev era could not but outrage that section of the party which still believed in its ideology, in however oblique a fashion. And a Communist Party, however degenerate, without some leaders who are socialists, is no more likely than a Catholic Church without some bishops and cardinals who are Christians, both being based on genuine systems of belief. Second, the educated and technically competent strata which actually kept the Soviet economy running were keenly aware that without drastic, indeed fundamental change, it would inevitably founder sooner or later, not only because of the built-in inefficiency and inflexibility of the system, but because its weaknesses were compounded by the demands of a status as a military superpower, which a declining economy simply could not support. The military strain on the economy had actually increased dangerously since 1980, when, for the first time in many years, the Soviet armed forces found themselves involved directly in a war. they sent a force into Afghanistan to establish some sort of stability in that country, which since 1978 had been governed by a local communist People's Democratic Party, split into conflicting factions, both of which antagonized local landlords, Muslim clergy, and other believers in the status quo by such godless activities as land reform and rights for women. The country had been quietly in the Soviet sphere of influence since the early 1950s without raising Western blood pressure noticeably. However, the USA chose or purported to regard the Soviet move as a major military offensive directed against the free world. It therefore, via Pakistan, poured money and advanced armaments without limits into the hands of fundamentalist Muslim mountain warriors. As was to be expected, the Afghan government, with heavy Soviet support, had little trouble in holding the major cities of the country, but the cost to the USSR was inordinately high. Afghanistan became, as some people in Washington undoubtedly intended it to be, the Soviet Union's Vietnam. But what could the new Soviet leader do to change the situation in the USSR, other than to end, as soon as possible, the second Cold War confrontation with the USA, which was hemorrhaging the economy? This, of course, was Gorbachev's immediate objective, and his greatest success, for within a surprisingly short period, he convinced even skeptical Western governments that this was indeed the Soviet intention. It won him a huge and lasting popularity in the West, which contrasted strikingly with the growing lack of enthusiasm for him in the USSR, to which he eventually fell victim in 1991. If any single man ended some 40 years of global Cold War, it was he. The aims of communist economic reformers since the 1950s had been to make the centrally planned command economies more rational and flexible by the introduction of market pricing and calculations of profit and loss in enterprises. The Hungarian reformers had gone some way in this direction, and, but for the Soviet occupation of 1968, the Czech reformers would have gone even further, both hoping that this would also make it easier to liberalize and democratize the political system. This was also Gorbachev's position, which he naturally saw as a way of restoring or establishing a better socialism than the really existing one. It is possible, but very unlikely, that any influential reformer in the USSR envisaged the abandonment of socialism, if only because this seemed quite impracticable politically, although elsewhere, trained economists who had been associated with reform began to conclude that the system, whose defects were first systematically analyzed in public from within in the 1980s, could not be reformed from within.